So I think we have some kind of quorum to begin right now.
Sure.
That way you can start.
Okay, good morning, everybody. We can hear some people whispering over there, which everybody can hear. So again, if you can, please mute your microphones when you're not talking to the group. Welcome, everybody. It's wonderful to have this group start off again. We went through book two, part two, over a period of several years as a Skype study, and that stopped, I think, 2 years back. And we are returning now to book two, part one. Now, book one also we have studied before, some of us together, but we recommenced the study of the life divine a number of years back, going backwards. So we started with book two, part two, and now we are at book two, part one, which is the section The Knowledge and the Ignorance, the Spiritual Evolution. Now, book one, which deals with what one might call the ladder of existence, lays out the ground for Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. Somebody's computer is making a lot of noise. Could you please mute your mic?
Seems better.
So that section deals with what one might call the ladder of existence, along with a number of other deeper issues connected with existence, life, evolution, etc. But mostly it might probably be useful to characterize it as a section that deals with ontology. Ontology meaning the question of being. What is reality? And how is it laid out in terms of consciousness? So some of that ground will enter into what we are studying right now, and as we study it, I think we'll get a clearer vision of what he has dealt with in that book one. But book two, part one, is really about epistemology, which is the question of knowledge. So, as you see, book two, it says the knowledge and the ignorance, the spiritual evolution. So, this is what book two is about. And he foregrounds this question of knowledge. How do we know? What is knowledge? How do we come to knowledge? What is there to be known? And how do we arrive at it? That becomes the gist of this section. So, part one says the infinite consciousness and the ignorance. And chapter one, which we will consider, begin with, is indeterminates, cosmic determinations, and the indeterminable. Now, a few things to remember as we are going into this. That Sri Aurobindo is writing this as part of what he called the Arya. And this is happening almost exactly 100 years from now, back in time. It's happening, we are in 2014, which is 100 years back from that momentous event in world history known as the First World War. And that's going on, and Sri Aurobindo is writing this text. He's serializing these essays in what is known as the Arya. And he revised some of them later, but a lot of this that we are reading is actually being produced at that time. Sri Aurobindo is coming at this from a number of directions, and that's why it's important for us to recognize that context or background of what he's engaging in these studies, in these writings. On the one hand, he's coming at it from the viewpoint of the Western understanding of epistemology, of the theory of knowledge in modern times. And when we talk about knowledge in modern times, we are talking about already a certain kind of a sort of split in the theory of knowledge that has taken place after the Enlightenment in modern times. And that split in knowledge is one which has occurred gradually to the point where for most people today, when we think about knowledge and how we know things, we think about science. Science, in fact, the word science is literally means to know, knowledge. Omniscient, which is knowing all, that which knows everything. So this way of knowing that we call science includes a methodology, the method of science, and it also includes a scope, which is what are we going to consider as valid...
Hello.
Hey, the call has started. It will be useful if we can, everybody else who's not speaking can mute the microphone.
We're actually at a wireless internet cafe, so we'll just listen for now.
Yeah, can you please mute your microphone? Thank you.
Yeah, so the method of science and the scope of science. So well, we know there's something called the scientific method, and we'll talk about it a little bit as we go into this. And then there is the scope of science, which is what are the valid questions that one can ask? What is our area of knowledge?
Please leave a message, and I'll get back to you shortly. And please press hash at the end of your message.
So that is one thing to keep in mind. That has happened over time, this notion of what it is that knowledge is all about, from what one might call pre-modern philosophy. So the area of philosophy was, you know, sort of the general domain in which questions of epistemology could be asked. What is it that we need to know? But from around the 17th century, there has been a gradual shift in that. One area, when we are talking about the scope of knowledge, one area within philosophy was what is called natural philosophy. Natural philosophy was philosophy pertaining to the material world and to nature. But over time, that area that was known as material philosophy has become dominant as science. And a split has taken place between what we call science and what we call philosophy. And philosophy, of course, is today more or less a subjugated discipline. So people don't talk much about philosophy, or they think about philosophers as ivory tower sort of thinkers. But the real domain of knowledge is considered to be science. But of course, as we know, the scope of science, the kind of questions we can ask in science are limited to the material world and to the notion of how things happen. And we'll see this background is present when Sri Aurobindo is raising the kind of questions he's raising in this section, this entire book. The other area that he is engaging in this study is Vedanta. And all these titles that we come across, the knowledge and the ignorance, the spiritual evolution, for example, which is the title for book 2, or part one, the infinite consciousness and the ignorance, indeterminates, cosmic determinations, and the indeterminable. All these have Sanskrit correlates. In a certain sense, they are coming out of the Indian Vedantic and Sanskritic philosophical tradition, Darshanic tradition. And particularly for those who are aware of it, it's very important, and I think it's a very important sort of aspect of the study to see how Sri Aurobindo is engaging the two traditions, the Western and the Eastern traditions.
Your recording has reached maximum length. To leave a specific callback number, enter the number including area code and then press hash. To leave no number, press hash twice. To cancel, press star.
Is it somebody's answering machine?
Yeah, looks like.
Okay. So we
to leave a specific callback number, it's enter the number including again, area code.
Yeah, it's better.
So we find that the Vedantic idea of knowledge, which is what is part of what Sri Aurobindo is bringing into this, divides the reality of knowing into the knowledge and the ignorance. These are the English words he'll use, and these translate in Vedanta to vidya and avidya. So ontology, the entire ladder of being, which he has introduced in book one, can be divided into the realms of knowing and the realms of unknowing, or the realms of knowledge and the realms of ignorance, vidya and avidya, as Sri Aurobindo will be talking about it. So whenever you see the word ignorance or you see the word knowledge, it's at some level you realize that he's engaging the Vedantic tradition of vidya and avidya, knowing and unknowing. And it's important to lay the ground of understanding that by knowledge and ignorance, what is meant is not what we normally take to be knowledge and ignorance, which is that we arrive at a certain kind of knowledge through deduction or induction or analogy or whatever other means which we use, which are all indirect ways of arriving at knowledge. All those indirect ways of arriving at knowledge are, according to this theory of knowledge, considered to be ignorance. So these are ways of arriving at knowledge in the ignorance. And these forms of knowledge are ignorant forms of knowledge, according to this theory. Knowledge with a capital L, K, or vidya, on the other hand, is something which is arrived at through identity of consciousness. In other words, you know because you are. There is no distinction between ontology and epistemology there. To know, to be, is to know. It's sort of as a kind of a self-evident knowledge of being. One is, and therefore one knows. So those realms of being in which the experience of being is the knowledge of being are the realms of knowledge. The realms of being in which experience only gives us knowledge through indirect means, empirical knowledge as we know it in our everyday life through the senses, for example, are realms of ignorance. Now, Sri Aurobindo, as we'll see through the study of this book 2, part 1, is going to try to engage these two traditions, two different traditions of understanding knowledge, the Western and the Vedantic, and also propose how one can mediate between these realms of knowledge and ignorance. What is the ladder between them? How can one arrive from ignorance to knowledge? And then this particular chapter that we are looking at, which is Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinations, and the Indeterminable, also has certain backgrounds in Vedanta. And there it is related to, again, the breakup of the realm of knowledge into the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. So this is how Vedanta breaks up the enterprise of knowing, epistemology, as that which is known, in other words, that which we receive as knowledge in our everyday understanding, what we take for granted as knowledge, and what we arrive at in a kind of a, you know, direct perception and understanding way, those are the known, the realm of the known. This realm of the known has got certain kinds of rules, laws, etc. to it. Behind the realm of the known is a vast unknown. There's a sense that these particular things that are unknown may enter into the known once we know them, that we can know them, but they are unknown. It's like a penumbra of darkness around the light. And then beyond that penumbra of darkness is the pitch blackness of something that cannot be known, the unknowable. It's important that Vedanta introduces this notion of the unknowable, because it is proceeding from a kind of assumption of radical infinity. Radical infinity means that there's always going to be more that cannot be brought to light, cannot be reflected on. That there's always infinitely more. So the indeterminable, that which can never be determined, exists at the edges of the that which is indeterminate, in other words, hasn't yet given itself to determination. And cosmic determinations, which are, you know, causally knowable and known in a certain sense. Now, that's the Vedantic way of understanding this entire, this chapter, in a sense. But as I said right in the beginning, there's another way in which he's engaging this, and he's engaging this from the understanding of the Western Academy of Knowledge, where there is a modern and a pre-modern understanding of philosophy and science. That you'll find also very, pervasive throughout this chapter. The philosopher Heidegger talks about our normal condition, because he's a philosopher, and he's also, in a way, a contemporary of Sri Aurobindo, and very importantly engaged with this very problem that we are talking about, the problem of knowledge, science, and philosophy. What is the kind of relationship between these three? And what are the kind of questions that science allows? And what are the kind of questions left behind? And he foregrounds this by talking about the human condition as a condition of thrownness. He uses the word thrownness. In other words, we find ourselves in a certain condition of existence. We are thrown into it. Nobody invited us there. We didn't go there of our own will. So, as a result, we find ourselves in a certain conditions with a certain consciousness and have to make sense of the existence in which we find ourselves. And this is the case not only for human beings, but also for anything which has consciousness. To experience is to already be thrust into a condition of experiencing, not to enter into it from a certain kind of a state zero. And so our knowing, our knowledge, begins with what we call practical knowledge. We try to make sense of something that we are thrust into, particularly from the viewpoint of being able to survive, being able to understand what to do to survive. And this is the ground of knowledge even prior to the human. Wherever consciousness exists, knowledge begins as a kind of practical knowledge. However, with human beings, we have another element of knowledge that arises, and the academy understands this by making the split between applied knowledge and pure knowledge. And the sciences are supposed to be about pure knowledge.
Can anyone hear me, or is this on hold?
Yeah, we can hear you. If you can mute the mic, once I finish talking, I'll be happy to, you know, sort of engage conversations. But if you can just mute the mic for now. So we have this whole area of knowledge as something which we are engaging from a practical point of view to begin with. Practical knowledge. And then we have another kind of knowledge. So the enlightenment arises from the notion that we can know, human beings can approach knowledge in a pure way. In other words, we have a faculty and we can want to know reality as it exists without bothering about how we are going to deal with it. Or how it's going to impact us. Can we know things as they are for their own sake, not for the sake of our applications? That becomes the whole enterprise of what is called pure knowledge. Now, of course, we may ask the question as to whether the idea of pure knowledge was existent before the Enlightenment or not, or whether it was existent in non-Western cultures. And both yes and no answers can be given. But in a systematic sense, modern knowledge is foregrounded by this kind of an effort to arrive at pure knowledge using certain methods, in a methodical way. So we find that there we define a domain. How are we going to arrive at the knowledge of the cosmos? And science itself arrives at it through a number of steps. Early history of the philosophy of science tells you that at first they said they want to use a method of pure empiricism. In other words, we will not bother to encumber our search for knowledge with any ideas. We will just do experiments and see, deduce out of the experiments what kind of laws, etc., come out. But very soon this is sort of contested by another tradition which says that, no, we need ideas because we are thinking beings, we get ideas, and today we may actually modify that even. I mean, people like Einstein wanted to modify that notion of ideas and say we get intuitions about reality and then we can conduct experiments to find out whether those intuitions are correct or not. We can deduce certain things out of the experiments and mediate between our experiments and our ideas through the language of mathematics. And we can find out whether indeed those ideas are correct or not. So we move from hypothesis through experiments to theories. But mind you, all this is happening within a domain which is bound by empiricism, bound by the senses and the knowledge of the senses. And it is also bound by certain kinds of questions, which are how questions. Again, it is the realm of thrownness. What is the mechanism in which we find ourselves? How is it that things run? You know, cosmological questions also appear. Like we try to answer the question as to how did the universe begin? And what is the way in which it is expanding or whatever? But even that cosmological question is ultimately a how question. The what question, or really the why question behind it, is not addressed. There is no why question. Now, certain scientists, particularly in the life sciences, have tried to engage this why question. They're talking about teleonomy, you know, the question of purpose. Purpose exists in living things. And how did that come into existence? Okay. So there too, science wants to bring that question down to the realm of necessity and chance. There are accidents that make it occur, and once things have occurred in a certain way, they develop a certain kind of necessity, that there is a determinism that appears. So those are the cosmic determinations. But prior to that, was there anything else that fed into that particular teleonomy? Was any will, purpose, existent, which has manifested through these things? That question is left unasked. It's outside of the domain of this way of knowing. So now, philosophy will ask this question, and Sri Aurobindo is asking this question. In this chapter, we'll find that in a way, Sri Aurobindo is engaging science with its own method, and he's using this method out of the Vedantic tradition. And interestingly, there are others who have made an attempt of this kind, particularly the contemporary philosopher Gilles Deleuze, who calls his philosophy transcendental empiricism. Transcendental empiricism, because he feels that these questions pertaining to transcendence, questions of ideas, intuitions, and he actually uses, he talks of his method as intuition as method. And this is exactly in a way what Sri Aurobindo will also be talking about, bringing it from the Vedantic tradition. He'll say, our method is intuitive. In other words, we use intuitions to ask the questions of reality which go beyond the borders of the how questions. We go to the why questions. And then we engage it empirically. In other words, we look at reality and see how it expresses these intuitions. And so in a way, Sri Aurobindo is bringing the Vedantic method into the modern method of knowing and opening up a revaluation of philosophy in modern terms. This is how I see this particular chapter, and in fact, this entire book one, part one. And I wanted to present this as a preamble so that we can keep this in mind as we go through this chapter. The way we'll proceed, of course, as I laid out in a few words, I'll stop and then take questions, comments, etc. You know, one of the things is this is a group study. A number of people are involved over here, and people are coming to this from many different directions and many different backgrounds. And I want to respect that, and I think we should respect collectively that reality and allow for questions, ideas, irrespective of what different contexts they are arising from and how long it takes. So let us not be in a rush, but let us also be focused so that questions, etc., are asked in a rigorous fashion and with serious intent, and we move on as a collective knowledge understanding together. So with that, I'll stop, and you can unmute your mic if you wish, and either comment or ask anything that you would like.
Any questions? Any comments?
Okay, if there are no questions or comments at this point, we'll continue. And I think what we'll do is we'll enter into a reading, and then if there are, you know, if you wish to engage what I spoke about later, you're welcome to do so. Somebody here now? Is somebody trying to say something? Okay, so I'll let Shyam handle the readings. I think we'll probably go through, since there's a large number of people, we'll ask people in an alphabetic order. And if you wish to read, then please go ahead and read. If you feel comfortable with reading, read. If you're not comfortable with reading, please pass it on to the next person.
Sure. So in the past, what we have done is we've gone in some kind of alphabetical order, and everybody reads one paragraph each. And at the end of the paragraph, Devashita will comment on it. And if there are questions, he'll take those two before we move on to the next. So the chapter we are reading is Book 2, Part 1, Indeterminates, Cosmic Determinants, and the Indeterminable. So that's page number... page number 205 in my version of the book.
295,
not 205. 295 in my version of the book.
Actually, its text version is 311.
Okay, yeah,
meaning
sure.
The hard copy.
Sure, there are probably a few variations in the editions. So I'll start with the first person on the call, Justin Ayers. Do you want to start with the first paragraph?
I'll be happy to look at this.
So, Justin, if you could read, when you're reading, read from the very beginning. There are some quotations, and then move on to the paragraph.
Okay, and you would like me to just read the, this is chapter one, Indeterminateness, Cosmic Determinations, and the Indeterminable. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and this will be the first quotation from the Mandukya Upanishad.
Yeah, you can go on until the first paragraph is complete.
Okay. The unseen, with whom there can be no pragmatic relations, unseizable, featureless, unthinkable, undesignable by name, whose substance is the certain certitude of one self, in whom world existence is stilled, who is all peace and bliss. That is the self that must be known. Mandukya Upanishad, verse 7. One sees it as a mystery, or one speaks of it, or hears of it as a mystery, but none knows it. Gita 2:9. When men seek after the immutable, the indeterminable, the unmanifest, the all-pervading, the unthinkable, the summit, self, the immobile, the permanent, equal in mind to all, intent on the good of all beings. It is to me that they come. That's in Gita 12, 3 and 4. How beyond the intelligence is the great self. Beyond the great self is the unmanifest. Beyond the unmanifest is the conscious being. There is nothing beyond the being. That is the extreme ultimate, that the supreme goal. That's from the Katha Upanishad, 1, 3, 10, 11. Rare is the great of soul to whom all is the being is the divine being. Gita. And this says Vasudeva Sarva Miti. 7:19. So this is then Aurobindo's text. A consciousness force, everywhere inherent in existence, acting even when concealed, is the creator of the worlds, the occult secret of nature. But in our material world and in our own being, consciousness has a double aspect. There is a force of knowledge, and there is a force of ignorance. In the finite consciousness, in the infinite consciousness, of a self-aware, infinite existence, knowledge must be everywhere implicit or operative in the very grain of its action. But we see here, at the beginning of things, apparent as the base or the nature of the creative world energy, an inconscience, a total nescience. This is the stock with which the material universe commences. Consciousness and knowledge emerge at first in obscure, infinitesimal movements at points in little quanta, which associate themselves together. There is a tardy and difficult evolution, a slowly increasing organization and ameliorated mechanism of the workings of consciousness. More and more gains are written on the blank slate of nescience. But still, these have the appearance of gathered acquisitions and constructions of a seeking ignorance which tries to know, to understand, to discover, to change slowly and strugglingly into knowledge. As life here establishes and maintains its operations with difficulty on a foundation and in an environment of general death. First in infinitesimal points of life, in quanta, life form, and life energy, in increasing aggregates that create more and more complex organisms, an intricate life machinery, consciousness also establishes, maintains a growing but precarious light in the darkness of an original nescience, into universal ignorance.
So we find that Sri Aurobindo begins this chapter with a number of quotations from the Vedantic tradition. They're either from the Upanishads or from the Gita. Three are from the Gita and two from two different Upanishads. And all of them have some commonalities. They all, in some way or the other, engage these three terms of knowledge that we've talked about: the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. And it's the highest, the unknowable, in a sense, that which exceeds the known and the unknown, and in a sense exceeds it radically. In other words, exceeds it in a way in which it has no pragmatic relations with the other two. That is being made into the origin of knowledge. And yet, it's being given a positive content. This is the important thing in these quotations, and gives us a prelude to what is going to come. It's being given a positive content in the sense that that is being called the conscious being. That is being called the me of the Gita, the supreme being of the Gita, the unseen with whom there can be no pragmatic relations, unseizable, featureless, unthinkable, undesignable by name. This is completely unknowable. Yet that whose substance is the certitude of oneself, in whom world existence is stilled, who is all peace and bliss, that is the self, that is what must be known. So this is on the one hand unknowable, yet it is one. This is a radical monism. Radical monism. There is only one, there is nothing but the one. And yet that one is so infinite that it has, in its essence, it is unknowable. There is nothing but that which exists, and yet that is unknowable. It is unknowable, of course, in the sense of knowing, which is reflecting on, which is giving content to that which is experienced. There is a radical remainder of infinity to all that can be said or experienced of it. It escapes formulation. That's where the second quotation from the Gita, one sees it as a mystery, or one speaks of it, or hears of it as a mystery, but none knows it. The term mystery that Sri Aurobindo is translating here is, interestingly, in the Gita, the Sanskrit term used is adbhuta. Adbhuta, adbhuta. Adbhuta literally means extra becoming, beyond the becoming, extra becoming. Adbhuta. And then the other two also, I'm not going to read them out, but in the other two, again, it's the same thing. It's the focus is taken into the indeterminable, the unmanifest. And yet that is being made into the Supreme Being. When men seek after the indeterminable, the immutable, the unmanifest, the all-pervading, the unthinkable, it is to me that they come. This is Krishna saying these words to Arjuna. The Supreme Self, the Supreme Being, who has taken form as a human being. And in the last one again, the second to last one, high beyond the intelligence is the Great Self. Now, beyond the intelligence is also capitalized here. By intelligence with capital I is meant not just the human intelligence, but the principle of intelligence. In other words, what the Western tradition would call the Logos. The source and origin of intelligence, the intelligent principle. Beyond that is the Great Self. And yet this Great Self is what we would call the cosmic self, the cosmic being, the cosmic Purusha. The cosmic Purusha is the unknown out of which the known has been determined. And yet beyond that is something else. Beyond that is the conscious being. The conscious being is beyond even the cosmic self. In other words, that's the unknowable which has determined itself as the cosmic being. So that hierarchy is being presented over here. At the same time, it's not a hierarchy. It's one reality. It's a reality in which the one being is in all things, and at the same time, it is infinite. And the paragraph that was read, he's presenting us with two forces. At first, he is reiterating something he has established in book one, which is that notion of a supreme consciousness that has manifested itself in all things. A consciousness force everywhere inherent in existence, acting even when concealed, is the creator of the worlds, the occult secret of nature. This is like a transcendental principle. Yet, this is not what we experience. So, but in our material world and in our own being, consciousness has a double aspect. What is it that we experience? We experience a puzzling reality in which knowledge and ignorance are mixed up. There is a force of knowledge and a force of ignorance. And depending on how you come down upon it, the world will have a certain kind of an appearance to you. Science has an assumption. And that assumption is that there are laws to the universe, that the universe is ultimately explainable. And it's explainable because, as he said, there is an intelligent principle in it. And so the notion is that there is a force of knowledge, as he's saying, the force of knowledge. Knowledge exists. The cosmic determinations exist, pervading nature, pervading the cosmos. And because we have intelligence, we can understand those laws. That is the force of knowledge. At the same time, we see that that's an assumption. There's a lot that cannot be understood. There's a lot that remains within the domain of chance. And then an entire new way of looking even at science appears, which is probabilistic, which bases itself on the mathematics of chance. Chance and necessity, as I said. which could be called the force of ignorance. The force of not knowing in terms of causation, in terms of laws. At the same time, we find that knowledge emerges as a conscious force, very precariously, yet it does emerge. That's what he's talking about in the rest of that paragraph, where he's talking about the fact that at the bottom of it all is a nescience. Matter is without self-knowledge. And out of it, something which is conscious, consciousness, emerges very precariously at points in little quanta which associate themselves together to form something like islands that have a little more endurance and try to survive, develop a will. So this is what he calls the tardy and difficult evolution, a slowly increasing organization, an ameliorated mechanism of the workings of consciousness that builds towards something that knows. So, as I said, the condition of thrownness, out of which we gather a sense of what it is we are thrown in, what are the laws, how can we deal with them. And so this arrival at a full grasp of what we are, the medium that we find ourselves in, is also constantly ridden with these two factors. Yes, we can know, and no, we can't know. At some level, we doubt everything that we know. There's a line in Savitri where he says, every thought is turbaned with a doubt. So this is exactly the force of knowledge. There's a sense that everything makes sense. And along with it, there is a sense that whatever sense we make of it is doubtful. It's the mingling of the force of knowledge and the force of ignorance, vidya and avidya, which form the ground of our existence. So that is the condition that he lays out over here. And he says that this is something which knowledge is a kind of hard-won prize that is not yet in our hands, as it were. It's through much effort that we are moving towards it. And at the same time, we are caught in this grip of the duality of knowledge and ignorance.
Any questions at this point?
Yeah, I have a... Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's all right. I think you first.
Okay, I was just wondering, can one make a sort of a correspondence between the three modes of the divine, the transcendent, the cosmic, and the personal? And these here, like for example, in the quotations here, Devashishu said that the conscious being would be the cosmic self, right?
I said that the great self, in one of those, you know, in the cosmic self, the conscious being is being used actually. Which quotation are you talking about? Now,
the fourth one.
The fourth one is saying the conscious being there is the transcendent.
The transcendent.
Yeah.
Yes. See, because and that's the same one, the unknowable of the first quote too, right? That
The first two, he's talking about that unknowable is the transcendent, exactly.
The transcendent, right. But then when Krishna says in the Gita about himself, me,
yeah,
would that be the personal divine then because he is incarnated in a human form or what?
It is the transcendent. The transcendent is incarnated in a human form, but it is the transcendent. The me he's talking about over there is the transcendent reality as being. So basically that's the point that's being made, is that the unknowable, which is completely beyond determination, is yet also a person and a being.
So then the personal divine would be the divine that each person experiences in himself or herself? What is then the personal divine?
Well, the personal divine would be, the personal divine would have different stadia or different stations of existence. The personal divine could be the immanent inhabitant within the ignorance. Okay? That's how you might experience the personal divine. But the personal divine could also be experienced as the overmind, Ishta Devata, the personal divine in the overmind. Or the personal divine could be experienced as the supreme transcendental being, in which case the personal divine no longer remains determinable by a personal form, but has now become that indeterminable reality.
Oh, I don't have to think about it. It's getting... really, like, complex, yeah. Let me think about it then. Thank you very much, yeah.
Well, that's exactly what's happening in the Gita. See, in the Gita, that's part of the entire journey of the Gita, is where the personal divine is the friend and human companion of Arjuna. But in the course of the Gita's colloquy, he's revealing himself to be the overmind Godhead, and finally the transcendental being without determination, and yet remaining personal. So, you know, these three stadia of existence are all stadia of the personal divine.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Keka, you had a question?
Yeah. I was just trying to analyze this, the terminologies like indeterminate and indeterminable.
Yeah.
So, just immediately, logically, it seems that there is a time factor, meaning indeterminate has a, as if like with time it can be known, as if like...
Yes.
There is a possibility to know it,
yes.
Whereas indeterminable goes beyond the realm of time, meaning, I mean, can it be said that this indeterminable, is it, can it be called like the, like, as quality, is it is different, like it is at a different layer of the same conscious being.
Yes.
Which manifests as a cosmic determinations at one poise, and another poise is things can be which boundlessly be known with time where the time starts.
Yes.
Meaning where the time is born.
Yeah.
And beyond that is another level where the time doesn't apply. So basically, if these three poises we think of, then it seems to me that indeterminable is actually ultimately the inexhaustibility, which translates in another layer as indeterminate.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly it. So it's that's why that translates in the Vedantic terms to the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. The indeterminable is outside of time and will always remain indeterminable. That's the radical infinity of being. Because the radical nature of infinity is that no order of infinity there can be orders of infinity. In other words, for example, even mathematically, we can talk about the infinity of all odd numbers, which is an order of infinity. It's bounded by the fact that it only takes in odd numbers, yet it is infinite. And he'll call that over here in this chapter itself, he'll call it as the boundless finite. But on the other hand, you have the radical infinite, which is outside of all determinations, that therefore it is indeterminable. And outside of time, it can never be determined. At the same time, it lends itself in, through a self-presentation, it lends itself to determinations. And those become determinations that are possible within the realm of time at some point. So we can talk of a cosmos. As soon as we talk about determinations that are determinable, we are talking of a cosmos, that then there's a bounding of some kind. It can be a boundless finite, but at the same time, there is a bounding of that kind.
When you're speaking of indeterminable, is this indeterminable in the sense of ananta, alinga, avishesha? I mean, there are many different qualities to this. What is this particular indeterminable? And is there a particular indeterminable that's related to kala, to time?
Yeah, so this is, in fact, all these terms that you use, they seem to be qualities for determinable, you know. And with relation to kala, this is akala, just as we talked about the fact that it's outside of time, because it doesn't lend itself to time. It figures itself within time. This is the reason why in a cosmos, we can talk of, as soon as we talk about time, we are talking about a construct, we are talking about a self-presentation, a certain kind of a framework or an axis through which it can present itself. You see, so it's a self-presentation. Maya enters into the picture as soon as we talk about time, or Shakti enters into its, or consciousness, Chit enters into the picture, because through that, you know, foundation, it can present itself. But in fact, Kali, that's why she is called Kali, because she is the one, the force of becoming that can take that which is outside of all determinations and give it a being in becoming. But this is outside of that.
Thank you.
Devashish?
Yes.
This is Owen.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to point out that I was struck in this first paragraph by the application, potential application to looking at evolution.
Yes.
And we find the smaller aggregates, which are mixed with ignorance and knowledge, as you say, being vidya and avidya, being the ground of being, these smaller aggregates as they're growing, I'm provoked to think of the evolution from atoms to molecules, to cells, to organisms, and the mutations that must take place, we find that the mutations for example, for a wing of a bird to take place, the chances of the non-lethal mutations happening in some cases are 1 in 17 billion. So there's very small chances, because it seems to me that so much of these mutations and so much of the evolution of life has been, as we discussed, ground in ignorance,
mm-hmm.
but also in some knowledge. There is some intelligent force that is guiding things ever so gently, but yet there's still so much ignorance that the chances of some of these evolutionary developments to occur are very, very slim.
Well, Owen, actually, I understand what you're saying. There is an evolutionary implication in what he's saying over here, but one has to be very careful because, if you frame the argument in terms of a creationism versus intelligent design kind of perspective, there is a slight problem, because is there an intelligence that is ever so gently guiding it along, or is there a hard-won arrival at knowledge? That's a very good question. That's the pertinent question. It's not necessary to assume that an intelligence is guiding it along. It may be that mechanisms of knowledge are arising within this sort of hard-won, movement towards individuation. Now, where did the movement towards individuation come from? That can be a question. But there is no necessity to assume that something is guiding it along. The cosmos may be a relative field in which, this power of intelligence is given, the power of knowledge is given equal weight with the power of intelligence, or the power of ignorance.
Mm.
You see.
So intelligence would arise in pockets here and there.
Yeah, now that's what, say, for example, let's take the argument of one of these molecular biologists who wrote a very important book. He's a Nobel Prize winner, Jacques Monod. He wrote this book called, I think it's either called Necessity and Chance or Chance and Necessity. I'm forgetting the order in which he puts it. And his argument is essentially a Darwinian argument in which he's saying that it's only necessity and chance that make living organisms persist and evolve and express the will to survive. Now, however, if you really read his thing, he's saying that what actually allows them, and we can take that argument even lower down to the atoms, is the emergence of forms of memory. The emergence of forms of memory which allow, which are inherent to the molecular basis of genetic life, allow certain types of traits to exercise themselves and persist. See? So the will to persist seems to be something which is extraneous to this notion of the will to arrive at knowledge, is extraneous to a pure ground of unknowing, But nothing external is actually pushing that along. It's arising within it, and it's being exercised by itself. It's an immanent feature.
Yes,
In other words, if you want to put it theologically, God is not externally making us grow up. God is internally in us growing up.
Right. And this could be leading back to the first sentence in the first paragraph.
Yeah.
Acting even when concealed.
Exactly.
Occult secret of nature.
Yeah.
Because it was really this first sentence that spurred me into this line of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found further confirmation with the aggregates, but I see what you're saying, and that's very interesting. I'll have to look at that book as well. Appreciate that.
Yeah, Leslie.
Yeah. I hope this is not topic too far, but one of the things that really impresses me about this work is how contemporary it is in some ways. The Life of Divine was, when was it first written?
Yeah, I was just mentioning that it was written in 1914, 100 years from now.
Wow. Yeah, and it was rewritten in the late 30s or...
Right, right. 40s. Ultimately, the last chapters of part two were rewritten in close to 1950, just before he died, in fact.
Yeah.
They're some of the last things he wrote.
We're dealing with a world-class intellect and a highly educated man who received much of his early education in England and is said to have read, you know, broadly. And when we read through this, at least with the kind of historical interest I have, I see connections with particularly Bergson, Henri Bergson.
Yes.
His notion of energy and consciousness. And of course, you have to bear in mind this was written less than 50 years after Darwin's Origin of the Species.
Yes.
So this whole evolutionary kind of idea is relatively new and was part of the ambiance.
Yeah.
But I'm particularly interested in the way people were talking about consciousness and energy in those days. And it was the beginning, right at the very beginning of quantum physics.
Yes.
And there are hints here and there.
There are. Even more.
Man has that in the back of his mind when he's talking about the physical world.
Yeah, there are. In fact, there's even more as we go on into this chapter. He's actually going to use some terminology out of quantum physics and things like that. Yeah.
Well, I'm just amazed and enjoying this, broad sweep of the mind of Aurobindo as he develops these ideas. You know, I've been reading books by Haridas Chowdhury, who was, as many of you know, the first president of the California Institute of Integral Studies, and recommended by Aurobindo himself. And Chowdhury had the same thing. You just read him, and you knew that he had